Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Scott Weidensaw. Let me again do a little bit of an introduction. He's the author of a number of books of natural history, including Return to Wild America, The Ghost with Trembling Wings. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his book Living on the Wind and Mountains of Heart. He's a federally licensed bird bander and makes his home in the Appalachians in Pennsylvania. And he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about his book, Of a Feather. The subtitle is A Brief History of American Birding, and it's published by Harcourt. Questions are certainly welcome. All you have to do to be a part of the conversation is to give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Scott, hello. Oh, and now we got you. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am. Oh. I hear you doing this morning.
Sorry, I'm okay. A little bit rocky here to start off on a Monday morning, but I'm sure we'll get things back on the tracks here just any second. I'm really glad that you could be with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here as well, and if there was any problem on this end, technically, I'm sorry about it, but, you know, these things happen with technology.
No, absolutely. As we depend on things to work, sort of every day. Most of the time they do amazingly well. Well, anyway, I'm really pleased to be talking with you and about this subject. I think, you know, for myself, I would count myself as a person who is really interested in birds and likes to see them. And I'd be very pleased if I would see something that I knew that I had never seen before. But I don't have the kind of a dedication to this pursuit that probably some people do. I think that one of the things you do in your book is raise this question, well, you know, people talk about tens of millions of birders in the United States. If you asked, if you try to find some way to figure out what is a really seriously dedicated birder, then what kind of number would you come up with?
Well, exactly. I mean, the federal government keeps track of interest in wildlife-based recreation, be it hunting or fishing or birding, and every couple of years they publish estimates on how many Americans are involved in those activities. And the latest estimate coming out from the federal government is, like, you know, more than 80 million Americans are interested in birds. Now, that is not to say that there are 80 million hardcore birders who are out there in the swamps at 5 o'clock in the morning listening for rails or traveling all over the country looking for rare birds in exotic places, but it means that there are an awful lot of Americans who are interested in birds, who are curious about birds, who enjoy having birds as part of their lives, whether it's because they put feeders up in their backyard in the wintertime for, you know, for grosbeaks and finches and nuthatches, or they have hummingbird feeders in the summer. The number, as you say, the number of people who are really serious hardcore birders is much smaller than that, but we're still talking about tens of millions of people. It's one of the most rapidly growing outdoor activities in the country and has been for a long time.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of going backwards from where we are now to the past. That's the reverse direction from which the book goes. But I'm interested in where things are now, and particularly the for some people, the enthusiasm to make either life lists or to go for a year, say, and say, we'll see as many different birds as we possibly can. I think also you mentioned the different odd sort of takes on how many birds can you see. Apparently there are some people who have done something where essentially they just sit down and they sit. And they say, how many birds can I see just from where I'm sitting right here?
It's called the Big Sit, and it happens every October. And the idea is you mark out a 17-foot-wide circle, and please don't ask me why they came up with 17 feet. I'm not really quite sure. And you stay there all day, and you see how many species of birds you can count within that circle. And birding has in a lot of respects, become very competitive. It's become, you know, somewhat sport-like in a lot of ways over the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. And, you know, you mentioned people keeping track of life lists. They've done that for a long time, but the idea of it's an idea of competing against yourself, basically. You know, how many species can I see within the boundaries of North America, north of the Mexican border, which is what most North American birders focus on. And, you know, and there are some sort of generally accepted rules for that. Some people take it much more seriously. Some people, as you say, do these big years where you see how many birds can you see in the course of a year. And you can do that in your own neck of the woods, whether it's in Pennsylvania or Illinois or whatever. But there are some people who will make this, a continental effort and will spend enormous amounts of money and expend, you know, it becomes their full-time job for a year, racing around the country. And just this past week, though, I met somebody who is doing this as sort of the antithesis of the hyper-technological, you know, mega carbon footprint big gear where people are zipping back and forth in jets from one side of the country to the other. A young man from Whitehorse up in the Yukon, and his father and mother who are traveling around North America doing a big year by bicycle. They've done about 10,000 miles already. I ran into them last week on the Gulf Coast in Alabama, where they were intercepting the spring migration, and they're trying to do a carbon neutral big year. So there's lots of ways that you can do this. But there's also, this is an interesting time in birding, because I think there's a growing realization that to some degree, just focusing on birds as inventory is a pretty superficial and shallow way of approaching birds. And most birders don't just view them as tick marks on a list. But there's, I think, a growing recognition among birders that because bird populations across North America are in serious trouble. I mean, many of the most beloved species of birds are their populations are declining, whether it's eastern meadowlarks or scarlet tanagers or wood thrushes, that we need to be giving something back to the birds. And so more and more birders are involved in what are known as citizen science projects, whether it's a state breeding bird atlas where you're helping to survey the entire bird life of the state on a very methodical and detailed level, almost square mile by square mile, or taking part in Cornell's Project Feeder Watch, where just simply by recording the species of birds that come to your backyard bird feeder through the winter helps take this continental snapshot of bird populations. It's a way to have fun while you're birding and also, you know, plow that information, plow those data back into the hands of scientists and wildlife managers and conservationists for the benefit of the birds themselves.
Mm-hmm. If you, I think this is true, and you can tell me whether it's true, if you look at the ranks of very dedicated, serious birders, there certainly are women who are involved in this activity, but it seems to me that it is still predominantly a male thing. Is that true?
I think as far as the real kind of testosterone-driven, hyper-competitive end of the sport, yeah, it's primarily male, and it's primarily men in their 20s and 30s. It's very much a young man's game. Birding is by no stretch of the imagination, though, mostly male, and I'm not sure if I have any numbers to back this up, but you know the sex ratio seems pretty evenly split to me. It's the really aggressive, competitive, you know, over the top listing oriented birding that really just seems to strike a chord with young men for some reason.
How did you get involved in birding at this level of interest?
Well, I mean, I've been a naturalist pretty much all my life. I mean, I was the kind of kid whose parents were forever finding snakes living under his bed, and you know, my mother would find toads and salamanders in my jeans pockets that I forgot to take out when I came down off the mountain. The birds and birding really became a particular focus for me when I was in junior high school, and then when I was in college and had the opportunity to take a course in ornithology from a really wonderful professor named Sam Gundy in Pennsylvania. It really awoke my interest in the science of birds. All of that kind of melded together so that my focus today is as much about bird conservation as it is about birding as a hobby. But the beautiful thing about it is it all blends together seamlessly. I just spent a week down on the Gulf Coast in Alabama with a group of friends who every year spend 2 weeks in the spring and 2 weeks in the fall banding migrant songbirds coming in across the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, these are birds that have just flown 600 miles nonstop from the Yucatan Peninsula, making landfall along the Gulf Coast in this very narrow strip of highly endangered coastal forest that is probably the single most important link in the entire Western Hemispheric migration chain. I mean, virtually all the migratory birds that come back to Illinois every year, the wood thrushes and tanagers and orioles and flycatchers and vireos and all the rest of them are passing up through this narrow, this little keyhole, if you will, in the migration chain. And by doing the work down there, you know, studying these birds, capturing them, banding them, weighing them, we're able to document the importance of those forests. It's a lot of fun. It's an incredible privilege to work with these, you know, beautiful birds, especially after having spent a whole long, cold, dreary winter up here in the Northeast. But it's also something that's very, very important for bird conservation. And all the folks doing this are volunteers. They're all avid birders that have taken this next step. This is the kind of citizen science approach that I was talking about before, where they're dedicating a big chunk of their lives every year to protecting the birds that make such a difference in their lives.
Yeah, I think it's noteworthy or important to note, as you did, that while if people look around them, they're going to see a lot of birds, numbers of birds. Certainly, around my house, you see plenty of things like sparrows and mourning doves and starlings and grackles and lots of robins and a goodly number of cardinals and a number of other things that you maybe see in smaller numbers. So if people look around them, they say, well, there are a lot of birds. But I think it's important to note that particular species and the diversity of birds is declining, and that does have a lot to do with natural habitat destruction. I suppose that's another reason why people are actually starting to see in urban areas birds that they had never seen before, because those birds are looking for some place to live.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you raise a really good point, which is there are birds and there are birds. And birds have different habitat requirements. Some of them are more adaptable in the face of the kinds of landscape changes that humans have made. The kind of fragmentation of forests and the creation of a lot of what's known as edge habitat. The creation of these vast areas of suburban backyards and office parks. Those kind of habitats are just perfectly designed for birds like Canada geese and American robins and house sparrows and grackles and blue jays. And so those populations are doing very, very well. Unfortunately, the majority of birds in North America, the 800-plus species of birds that breed here, are much more specific in their habitat requirements and much less adaptable to the kinds of changes that we've created in North America. And so, many of the populations of these really beloved birds have been in serious decline for more than four decades. Last summer, the National Audubon Society released a report called Common Birds in Decline, where they used the Christmas Bird Count and the Federal Breeding Bird Survey and a number of other data sets to show that the populations of many of our most beloved birds have declined in some cases by 70, 80, even 90% in the last 40 years. These are species like eastern meadowlarks that I mentioned a moment ago that are still widespread and are still by any reasonable measure common. But if you look at the direction that the trend line is going, it ought to worry us, because if even the most widespread common birds are having a hard time thriving, that's a warning sign to us that we've got some serious problems that need to be addressed.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Scott Widensall. He's a naturalist and author. He's written a number of books. He lectures widely on wildlife and environmental topics. His most recent book is Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, and it's published by Harcourt. I want to take a second here to also urge people who are listening to Focus 580, who appreciate the show and others that they hear on WILL, to support it. We don't want public radio to become an endangered species.
No, we do not.
And Les Schulte is here in studio with me to help make the argument. People can take the opportunity right now, if they would like, to go to the phones or go to their computer and make a pledge.
Sure. You know, I have some good friends who are birders, and they travel all over the place, all over the world, to look at birds and look at exotic species and things that they really want to see and really want to have. But they really appreciate public radio. And that's right here. WILL is right here. And you don't have to travel all over the place to listen to great programs. However, you know what the interesting thing, David, is that since we're on the web and on our website, people all over the world do listen to these programs. I listen to or look at the report that we get monthly about the people that visit our website, which pages, and the AM 580, Focus 580 interviews, and the Afternoon Magazine interviews. The podcasts are some of the most viewed or hit pages, I guess you would say. I'm not very hip on this language, so pardon me there. But I know the downloads, that's the word I'm looking for. The downloads of our interviews are some of the most popular pages. And, think about it. If you use your iPod, and I know a lot of people that listen to these interviews on their iPod because they listen to them when they drive around and they travel. But some of these same people will pay 99 cents for a song to download onto their iPod. If you had to pay for a Focus 580 interview, or if you had to pay for an afternoon magazine interview, would you do it? You probably would. You probably would pay a dollar to listen to a great interview. But we're not asking you to do that. We're really asking you just to invest a couple of dollars a week into this public radio station to help make the goals that will make the programs necessary for next year. That's why we're asking you to right now to make a $40, $52, or $100 contribution to WILL. The number to call is 217-244-9455, or, of course, you can go online to willpledge.org right now and make that contribution right there.
All right. Thank you very much, Les. And once again, we want to introduce our guest, Scott Widensall. He's an author, naturalist, written a number of books of natural history, and his most recent is the book Of a Feather. It is a brief history of American birding, and it's published by Harcourt. So if you're interested in birding, you might want to take a look at the book or look at some of his other books. And, of course, here this morning on Focus 580, if you have questions, you want to call in, talk about birds, you can do that, too. The number for this show, now this, no one will expect you to pledge. You'll come right here to this show. Same number as always, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Scott, I want to get back here to our conversation, and we've talked a little bit about where birding is today. And if you ask this question, well, who are the important figures in establishing modern birding as a hobby that a lot of people are interested in, or, you know, people like me who are maybe not going to go across the country to see a bird, but I'm always interested in looking around and seeing what I can see. Probably the one person who's more important than anybody else would be Roger Torrey Peterson.
Oh, absolutely.
And because he made one of the first and most popular, and has did that for a long time, field guides, so that you could actually have a handy pocket-sized book that you could look into to try to identify birds that you're seeing.
That's right. I mean, now, Peterson did not invent the field guide. What he did was essentially reinvent the concept of the field guide in 1934 and make it into something that was accessible to the average person. As you said, it was easy to carry around. You could slip it in your back pocket. I know many birders who have their old copies of Peterson guides that have kind of a permanent bend that pretty much fits their backside because it rode in their hip pocket for so many years through rainstorms and everything else. But he was drawing on, as he made clear himself all the time, and Peterson was very humble about what he did. He recognized that he changed the way people looked at the natural world. But he also drew on a number of important antecedents that allowed him to create this new field guide in the 1930s. Peterson was an interesting guy. You know, this is the centenary of his birth this year. He was born in 1908 in western New York in Jamestown up along Lake Ontario. And he was put onto birds by one of his elementary school teachers. And he became hooked at an early age. You know, his idea of taking a girl on a date was taking her on a 17-mile frog march across the landscape, you know, looking for birds. He was a self-taught birder and naturalist, kind of lived in a bit of a vacuum in western New York. But then when he was in his late teens, he moved to New York City to attend art school, and he fell in with a group of young men called the Bronx County Bird Club, and they were disciples of a man named Ludlow Griscom at the American Museum of Natural History there in New York City. And Griscom was really kind of the proto-modern birder. He was an academically trained ornithologist, but he loved birding just for fun, and he was the one who really put the pedal to the metal when it came to creating life lists and doing big days and this whole kind of competitive, list-oriented, let's see if we can top our own record approach to birding that is so much fun. And, you know, these young men, these teenage boys in the Bronx County Bird Club just embraced that. And so Peterson was able to take his art background, his academically trained art background, along with all of this incredible field experience that he gained with, learning from Griscom and some of these other really, really top ornithologists. And in 1934, poured all that into this small pocket-sized book with very simple, very schematic illustrations. The idea was not to create great art. It was to show as little of the bird as was necessary to identify it. And so the art was very simplified. The images were very small. There were little arrows pointing to the important field marks that would tell you how to identify each bird. it came out, you know, in the middle of the Great Depression. Houghton Mifflin didn't, you know, they had so little faith in it that they required him to give up his royalties on the first 1,000 copies that were sold. The first printing sold out in a matter of a couple of days, and it hasn't been out of print since then.
I wonder just offhand whether you, there are different kinds of books. There are certainly the books like this that have illustrations, and as you say, that often what they'll do is they'll call your attention to some particular feature, because that's going to be a key thing. If you're only going to get a quick look, you really need to know what exactly to look for, and certainly there are various kinds of species that look, to the untrained eye, they look very much alike. So to tell them apart, it may sometimes be difficult.
Some of them look pretty alike to the trained eye, too. You get into things like gull identification and immature hawks. There are certain groups of birds that just cause birders' eyes to roll back in their head, and they start to foam at the mouth a little bit because they're so challenging. The great thing about birding, of course, is that there are sort of entry-level birds that anybody can recognize, you know, the blue jays and the scarlet tanagers and things like that. But there's always this next level to carry yourself to, next level of challenge.
Do you think that if you were going to start out that you would recommend that as opposed to, well, for example, I think I have a book, and I think it's an Audubon book, and I suppose I've seen others where what you get is a photograph of the bird.
Well, that's actually, you know, schism is the natural human condition, and you have the partisans of the illustrated field guide and partisans of the photographic field guide, and never the twain shall meet. The problem with photographs is that you have an image of a single bird taken in a single position at a single moment in time, and you're really at the mercy of film and lens and lighting, and so you can end up with some very awkward-looking birds that don't really look that much like what they look like most of the time, with shadows and highlights that may mask some of the colors and tones. Whereas with an artistic illustration, with a painting or a drawing, the artist is able to convey sort of an idealized image of what that species of bird looks like most of the time, because, you know, there are millions of individuals in each of these species, and each one varies a little bit in color and shape and posture. Each approach has its advantages and disadvantages, obviously. You know, when you have an illustrated field guide, you're filtering that through the biases and abilities of the artist, and, you know, if the artist is really good, that's great, and if not, you pay a price for that. Interestingly, one of the newer field guides, and one that I generally recommend as a really, really good beginning field guide, is by Ken Kaufman, and it's simply called the Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds. And what Ken did is used photographs, but he digitized those photographs and then manipulated them to color balance them, to get the proportions right, so that what you see in the photograph is very, very close to what you're going to see most of the time in the field. And I think it's a wonderful compromise between these two approaches to field guide illustration, and it's one that, it's also the way the guide is laid out is just very easy for a beginner to use and not to be intimidated by.
Let me just very quickly introduce our guests again for this part of Focus 580, Scott Wiedensahl. He's written more than 24 books on natural history, and a number of them about birds. That's a particular interest of his. He's also written for different publications, including the Smithsonian, New York Times, Nature Conservancy, National Wildlife, and Audubon. And his most recent book, the one that we were talking about here this morning, is A Brief History of American Birding. The title is Of a Feather, and it is published by Harcourt, and the book is out in the bookstores now. And if you'd like to read it, you certainly head out to the bookstore or the library and look for the book. Also, by the way, if you have questions you'd like to call in here, and we have somebody ready to go, that's certainly welcome. The number, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. That's the number to call. We do have someone here to talk with in Atlanta, Illinois, and that is on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Great conversation, one of my favorites about birds. I just wanted to ask a question, since we're talking about bird guides, although it's not definitely not pocket size, what's your opinion of Sibley's guide and how it's affected bird watching?
Well, the Sibley Guide to Birds came out in the fall of 2000, which at the same time the Kaufman Guide that I mentioned before, and it, I think for most serious birders, it is the gold standard. David Allen Sibley, if ever anybody was born to write the ultimate field guide, it was probably David. His father, Fred Sibley, is a very well respected ornithologist. They lived in a number of places around the country. I know David has told the story once about coming home to their home in California and discovering a California condor chick in the garage that his father had rescued. By the time he was 11, he had decided he was going to write the world's best field guide. And he spent much of his young adult life as a field trip leader, taking birding tours around the country. He had this self-imposed goal of seeing, identifying, and drawing 600 species of North American birds per year for 10 years. Now, most of us will spend much of our lifetimes just seeing 600 species of North American birds, much less doing that every year for a decade. So then he took all of this information in the late 90s and kind of poured this into this, as the caller suggests, this really big, rather thick, not really suitable for the field guide. It's not the sort of thing you can stick in your back pocket. You have to carry a pack. You could probably use it to stun a bear if it got too close to you. But it's a wonderful field guide. I mean, never has there been a field guide with as much information, as much detail, as many different plumages. I think there are 40 different illustrations of different plumages and ages of red-tailed hawks alone. The problem, of course, is, as I said before, that can be very intimidating to a beginning birder or somebody who's just been at it for a couple of years. And so that's specifically why Ken Kaufman and his guide tried to fill the other end of the niche. These two guides are both wonderful, and they're both complementary, and they aim at different levels of the birding market. The other thing I'll say about Ken's guide is that Houghton Mifflin, at Ken's urging, a couple of years ago came out with a Spanish language version of it, because we have, 28 million people in this country who don't speak English at home as their first language. And, that's a huge demographic that birders ought to be reaching out to. I mean, this has been a very middle class, very white hobby for a long time. There's a lot of other people out there that would enjoy birds if only they were exposed to it.
Well, it's a great topic, and I really appreciate the background on Sibley, which I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but very, very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you go back and look at not only ornithologists but other naturalists, and certainly you'll go back into the 19th century, you see that there are a lot of people who, one of whose main techniques for studying the animals, drawing them, was shooting them.
That's right.
So that they could be closely studied that way, so that they could be mounted, so that they would go into museums and other exhibitions. And certainly that it was true of birders as other kinds of naturalists. Some of the most famous ornithologists of the 19th century, I expect, shot an awful lot of birds, which is something that today just the idea just horrifies us, that they would, that someone like Audubon, for example, Audubon shot an awful lot of birds in his lifetime. And how do we understand that? Put that in some kind of context for us.
That always is mortifying to birders to find out that, John James Audubon, who has become this icon of bird conservation, spent most of his career shooting birds because he had to. All of these early ornithologists in the 18th and 19th century, I mean, put yourselves in their shoes. They're confronting this huge continent awash with birds. There are no field guides. There are no lists of species. These birds come in different plumages depending on the season of the year, whether it's a male or a female, whether it's an adult or immature. They're trying to make sense of this confusion. They have no binoculars. They have no cameras. There's no optics of any kind. The only way to get that tiny little bird that's high up in a treetop down close enough where you can even identify it is to put it in your hand. And the only way to do that was to shoot it. These birds were not wasted. They were shot. As you said, they were skinned. They usually were not mounted in a lifelike position. They were made into what are known as specimen skins, with kind of stiff and cotton in their eyes and wings folded up at their sides. And those specimens, most of them still remain in the museums of the world. They will last almost in perpetuity if they're well taken care of. Many of Audubon's specimen skins, in fact, are still extant. They're still used by ornithologists, especially those of species like passenger pigeons and Carolina parakeets that have become extinct, not because they were collected by, you know, this relative handful of ornithologists, but because they were shot by commercial market hunters and folks like that, or suffered from habitat loss in the case of ivory-billed woodpeckers. So, you know, it seems so incongruous today, this idea of shotgun ornithology, but it was really a necessary stage in the development of ornithology. And by the late 19th century, that was fading away. You had more and more people, like Ludlow Griscom, the guy I mentioned earlier, at the Museum of Natural History in New York, who had a foot in both worlds. You know, you had these old-time, you know, museum men, and they were almost all men, who believed that the only way to document the presence of a bird was to shoot it so you had a specimen in your hand so you could say, see, I found this olive-sided flycatcher on such and such a date in such and such a place. And then as birding became more popular in the 1880s and 90s and in the early years of the 20th century, you had an explosive rise in the number of bird clubs, lots of amateurs out there seeing these birds, and they're reporting what were essentially sight records, where all you had to go on was their say-so, and the museum men did not like that at all. And there was a lot of grumping and harumphing about the loss of objectivity and the loss of accuracy in these reports. But Griscom and others recognized that what you lost in that accuracy, certainly there were going to be mistakes because people make misidentifications all the time, but you had this vast army of bird watchers out there watching the birds, monitoring their movements, and Griscom in the 1920s predicted, I think very accurately, that this would mean, you know, so much more ornithological information than we ever could have gotten just simply from this shotgun approach to ornithology.
We will talk some more with our guest, Scott Weinsall, in just a moment, and also talk with some callers. We have some people waiting, and I hope that they wouldn't mind just being patient for a moment or two, and we'll right get to their comments. If you're interested, by the way, look for Scott's book. It's titled Of a Feather. It's a Brief History of American Birding, and it's published by Harcourt. You know, if this was a commercial radio station, there would be several points during the interview what I might have to say to a guest. Well, you're making a very interesting point there, but just hold on. We have to pause here so that we can have a message from our sponsors. Well, this is public radio. We don't do that, but we want to make sure that people who are listening know that, yeah, we do actually have sponsors, and they're you. The people who listen to the station supply the money that makes Focus 580 and a lot of other programs possible on WILL. In fact, more than one out of every $3 of our operating income comes from listeners, and that's why it is really important for us a couple of times a year to remind you of that fact, and this is one of those times. So if you're not a supporter of the station, and I mean not just a moral supporter, I mean a financial supporter, why don't you take the opportunity this morning to make a call and make a pledge, 244-9455. That's the number to call. Yeah. Les Schulte is here with me in the studio. He's one of the folks who spend all of their time trying to get people to support WILL.
And you know, and the people who do support WILL, and we've heard from hundreds of people and listeners so far during this spring drive, and we thank each and every one of them. If you've done that so far, thanks a lot. The folks who do support WILL, they don't understand why the people who listen to these stations don't, because they say, well, it's a no-brainer. I mean, if you use the service, then you would want to do that, wouldn't you? And unfortunately, it's really only about 1 out of 10 folks who actually step forward and make that contribution and become not just a listener to the station, but a contributor to the station. And that's what keeps great interviews, like the one we're having right now, on the air. 244-9455 is the number to call. We're just over $101,000 so far in the spring drive, but our goal is $200,000, and we're getting into the last couple of days of the drive, of the shortened spring drive, because we've shortened them up because you've asked us to. But to be able to do that, that means you can't wait like 4 or 5 more days. You need to call right now, 244-9455, or go online to willpledge.org. You know, if you are a birder, might be great for you is a WILL tote bag to carry your books.
Put some birds in there?
Put some birds in. You can put some little birds in there. You can put your glasses. You can put all kinds of stuff in there. And that's just with a pledge of $100 or more. You can choose that as your thank you gift. 244-9455 or willpledge.org. Do it right now.
All right. Thank you, Les. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Weidensall. His book, Of a Feather, is a Brief History of American Birding. He's written a number of books on environmental and natural topics, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have several callers here, and we'll start talking with folks who are listening, and we'll begin with someone in Charleston. And this is Charleston, Illinois, that is, and that's line number four right here. Hello.
Thank you. Would he comment, please, if he cared, how would he talk about the authenticity of the Beam porcelain reproductions of birds? I'd appreciate his comments. Thank you.
Well, I have a rather scanty knowledge of them. I have the John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove in Pennsylvania has a fairly extensive collection of these. These are small porcelain figurines that I believe were produced in the 1960s and early 70s, and there was they did a collection of, you know, most of the species of North American songbirds. Most of the ones I've seen are good, but most birders would point out that the proportion's a little off. The heads are a little big. I think that makes them look a little bit cute. And some of the colors are off. But for the most part, it's pretty amazing. I also think that the Ward Wildlife Art Museum in Salisbury, Maryland, has an extensive collection of them. But it's porcelain figurines are not a particular specialty of mine, so I'm a little out of my depth here.
All right. Well, I hope that at least is a partial answer for the caller. Let's go on to someone who is on a cell phone. This is the next, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm a supporter, and I wanted to say there are two things that I've found that are helpful to sort of casual bird watchers. One is there's a new little software product that goes with a Palm Pilot, and it's you can get it through the National Geographic product, but you can get it through either Orbis or National Geographic, and it shows you pictures of the birds. Hang on a second here. The pictures of the birds, it shows it a couple different ways, and it also gives you the bird call, and you can search for the birds based on things like habitat and when you're seeing it and so forth. It's got my husband sucked into looking for birds. The other thing is there's a CD collection called Birding by Ear, and it's really nice because it starts you out with bird and groups birds together, and it starts you out with easy ones. There's one set for eastern U.S. birds. Got to go. I'm at getting my car repaired.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well,
bye.
Thanks for the call. Well, I think that's an interesting suggestion. I think particularly when the caller talks about recognizing the calls, because there are sometimes you don't always get a very good look at a bird. It may be fleeting, and one of the things that can help you identify the bird is if you know what the song is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a skilled birder probably does 80 or 90% of his or her identification by ear rather than by sight, because birds are very vocal. They have very distinctive vocalizations and songs. You can hear them long before you see them. A lot of these birds are up in the treetops or they're calling at night, and it can be very confusing when you're getting started. And some of us are much better than others at learning bird songs and just learning vocalizations in general. I am not particularly good at it. And so I have exactly the CD set that she was talking about, Birding by Ear and More Birding by Ear. I keep it in my car, and starting about February, when I've gotten thoroughly sick of snow and ice and winter weather, when I'm driving around, I just pop these things in, and what they do is they sort of create a field guide of sound for you by lumping, pairing up similar groups of birds so that showing you the differences between them, and just by repetition, it'll come naturally. She also raised a good point, which is that there's so much technology that's available now, which makes it so much easier to do certain things. Of course, it used to be if you heard a song in the field that you didn't recognize, you had to come home and get out your big 33 RPM long playing record and put it on there and hunt around until you finally found. Well, now of course you can just download all the stuff into an MP3 player like an iPod, take it out on the field. If you're birding and you want to get a closer look at that bird, you can play a recording of that song, and you don't want to do that too often or too close to the nest, but the bird will come charging in to chase this intruder out of its territory. the technology has just made leaps and bounds. You can carry all this information with you in the field, and makes it so much easier to make those identifications, and even to record the birds. I mean, I have friends who have found rare birds, you know, looking through their spotting scope or their binoculars, and have actually taken a picture using their cell phone to document that bird, and within minutes emailed that around and said, "Hey, look what I found."
Okay, let's talk with someone else, and this will be someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You were talking earlier about Audubon, and I just wanted to mention that the university library has a copy of the Audubon folio and also a facsimile of the prints, and we're doing a display right now on the endangered and extinct birds from the Audubon folios. It's in the main library north-south corridor, so the public is welcome to come and take a look.
Oh, great. Well, thanks very much. They're extraordinarily beautiful if you get to see what these things look like. And in anything that you've seen reproduced in a book, I think it's nothing compared to when you can actually see the genuine item.
Oh, it's true. They're gorgeous, gorgeous works of art.
Yeah.
They really are. I had one of the greatest experiences of my life last year. Had the opportunity to curate a John James Audubon show at a nature and arts center in Pennsylvania that I'm involved with, where we had all four of the Birds of America elephant folios that she's talking about half a dozen original Audubon paintings there. And, I mean, for those who've never seen the elephant folios, they're called that because they used the largest sheets of paper that were available in the 1830s. Audubon was painting these birds life-size, even if they were trumpeter swans and whooping cranes. And these incredibly complex compositions, the colors are vibrant, the birds just seem to spring off the page. And all you have to do is look at what came before Audubon, the rather stiff very dead-looking illustrations of people like Alexander Wilson. I mean, that was the tradition for hundreds of years, and then Audubon completely broke the mold. And again, like Peterson, a century later, changed the way that we look at the natural world. So yes, I would encourage people to take advantage of that opportunity to see those original prints up close and personal.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Let's go on here to a caller in Palestine. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. I'm down in the Wabash Bottom, and I see a lot of bald eagles and swans, and I actually had to drive through some water to get here. My question was, I don't quite understand conservation, where they're into numbers. And, we had a lot of our wheat destroyed by, snow geese. And then turkeys, their numbers just keep doubling. And I just wondered what... Are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Yep. Okay.
Well, if I can jump in for just a second, I think you raise a good point, which is that there's such a thing as too much of a good thing. In the case of snow geese, these are birds that breed in the Arctic, up in from the Hudson Bay and on north, which traditionally wintered along the Gulf Coast, and fed when they were down there on spartina and other marsh plants, and that's not a very good diet, and so it tended to keep the numbers of these birds fairly low. It kept their population relatively low. But over the last 150 years, we've created all of this farmland, all of this grain land, whether it's rice in the Gulf Coast area or corn and soybean and wheat up here in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and the Midwest. And so the population of snow geese has just exploded. We're talking about millions and millions of snow geese in such numbers that they're actually badly damaging their breeding grounds up in the Canadian Arctic, because all these birds go back to these traditional breeding colonies at places like Cape Churchill on Hudson Bay, and they have just eaten the vegetation down to mud across enormous swaths of what had been very rich coastal tidal marsh and tundra up there. And, you know, there's only so much we can do about that. The Fish and Wildlife Service has extended hunting seasons on snow geese. They've increased the bag limits, tried to make it as easy as possible for goose hunters to take as many snow geese as possible. But, you know,
why are there any restrictions at all?
Well, if you look at, you know, we're talking about hunting seasons that last from almost the time the geese get here until almost the time they go back, with a 10 bird per day bag limit in most areas. I mean, I don't think we'd want to see anybody out there, you know, reverting to the old market hunting days when you just blasted them in huge numbers and hauled them off to market. But I understand that for a lot of farmers and for land managers, even on wildlife preserves, it's been a problem. I can't speak too much to
And the turkeys, do you have complaints about the turkey multiplication that's taking place?
Well, we're hearing the same thing here in Pennsylvania. Of course, I'm not really up on what's going on exactly in Illinois, but we're starting to get crop damage complaints here in Pennsylvania because of large numbers of turkeys. And I know our state game commission has basically doubled the opportunities for turkey hunters to go out. But, you know, the numbers of hunters are going down year after year. There are fewer and fewer people taking up the sport, and so it's, you know, the amount of the number of birds that hunters can take has been decreasing as well.
Well, there are some full seasons on some. It's almost like protecting the locusts, you know.
You're protecting what? Sorry,
the locust.
Well, I don't know if it's quite that bad, but I certainly understand if you're in the bullseye for a flock of.
Well, if you eat bread, it's going to affect the price, you know.
Sure.
After a while.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the comment, and I'm sure that there are some people might have similar feelings about white-tailed deer.
Oh yeah.
We have things. If people don't hunt anymore, and there are fewer hunters, and we have done things to eliminate the natural predators, then there can be explosions of these animals because there are really no controls on them.
Right.
And I suppose that again, if we've done things to destroy habitat, then that just means that they're going to be. It's more likely that where we want to live is where they're going to be forced to try to make a living.
Well, and we've kind of created the perfect habitat for white-tailed deer with this badly fragmented landscape, and the over-browsing by white-tailed deer has had a really devastating impact on the populations of many forest-nesting songbirds because that rich understory where species like Acadian flycatchers and least flycatchers and indigo buntings nest is gone because the deer have just eaten it. So it's had an impact on many, many species of birds.
We're just about the point we're going to have to finish, and there's a lot more in this book that we haven't talked about, particularly the early American experience. Just real quick, because I know it's something you've written on, can you give me a minute on the ivory-billed woodpecker? Do you think that, in fact, that the reported sighting was not really an ivory bill?
I actually remain cautiously optimistic. I think that the evidence that both in Arkansas, in the big woods of eastern Arkansas, and the Chockahatchee River in northern Florida, where Jeff Hill and Dan Minnell and some other folks from Auburn University have been working, is pretty compelling. I mean, they've got recordings that sound, boy, an awful lot like ivory bills, and people who are good, solid field biologists, good, solid observers, making claiming eyewitness reports. And I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt and give it a couple of years and see what they turn up, because this is a species that we've written off so many times in the past, despite the fact that there have been a constant litany of reports ever since the 1940s in many of these bottomland forests. We're finally doing the kind of search today that should have been done 60 years ago for that bird.
Well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Scott Widensall. He's authored a number of books that have to do with natural history, including Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. His last name is spelled Weidensall. Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.